I want to welcome you all to another lecture in our series of presentations from the Institute for Christian Worship here at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. Our guest for these several days is Dr. Harold Best, serving for many years as the Dean of the Conservatory of Music at Wheaton College, an author, philosopher, speaker, and friend. Harold is going to speak with this class. The class is Christian Worship and Contemporary Culture, and our at least where the lecture will begin is with a title of Authentic Multiculturalism and High Culture, What of Quality? So would you help me welcome Dr. Harold Best.
Thank you. Thank you. If you don't mind my sitting, I occasionally have to pay obeisance to a very bad back, and standing too much doesn't always work. The title sounds highfalutin. I don't want the content to be, but the title, despite the fact that it sounds sort of hoity-toity, it's an important subject for several reasons. High culture has become a dirtied-up term when, in point of fact, it has never meant it has never intended to dirty anything up. Multiculturalism is a current term that in some ways has dirtied itself, even though, as I suggested yesterday, in a theological sense, multiculturalism is one of the most dignified isms that we can encounter. Quality is a word that fluctuates in meaning depending upon the worldview of the people using the word. It is a word that is both a servant word and a slave word. We can become servants of quality, or we can become slaves of quality. And I shall try to differentiate between servanthood and slavery. When it comes to quality, I shall try to differentiate between political multiculturalism and authentic multiculturalism before I'm done. And then I want to try to talk about quality in a way that does not lean for its substance on philosophical aesthetics. I asked your permission yesterday to read at certain times, and I shall do so today. But I'm not going to read from text until I'm about halfway through. I will not be approaching these words, multiculturalism, high culture, and quality, as if they were 3 points in a sermon. I'm going to go about it synthetically or synthesistically in hopes that when we're finished, we will not be dealing so much with three categories as a unity within which we have certain special topics. First of all, I want to talk just a little bit about greatness and goodness. Partly for reasons that I mentioned yesterday, because we live in a culture of exaggeration, wherein everything is great or awesome or magnificent or extraordinary or unique or really unique or really, really unique. And because we live in a culture that has robbed language of its true force, because we live in a culture in which the transcendent categories in our language, those words dealing with transcendence, for instance, awesome or magnificent or extraordinary, because those words are now used to describe the newest BMW or the latest cheese and spinach quiche. We have no words, almost literally, left to talk about transcendence in the most fundamental sense of the word. So that when we sing the Rich Mullins song, "Our God is an Awesome God," and I have no quarrel with that song, per se, nor with Rich Mullins as a person, whom I knew him more than slightly before he was killed. One of the most sincere Christian musicians one can get to know. I have no quarrel with the song, "Our God is an Awesome God." I have quarrel with the way that awesome has been slangified and brought down to a point where we no longer really can use the word in reference to God without a flood of associative examples coming to our minds having to do with everyday affairs. Greatness is kind of one of those words that fluctuates in meaning and has been almost overused out of existence. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, the word greatness, especially in the arts, has become such a powerful word that artists are afraid to do anything that is not great. On the artistic side of the word, we have our vocabularies, our repertoires of masterpieces, legitimately so. Masterpieces that can legitimately said to be great. When I think of the Bach B minor Mass, when I think of the Jupiter Symphony of Mozart, when I think of the Brahms Intermezzi, I think of greatness. That would be on the classical side. When I think of Keith Jarrett, the jazz improvisateur, or I think of Count Basie, within the categories of jazz, I can legitimately think of greatness. If I were to talk about bluegrass, I would have to talk about Bill Monroe within the category of bluegrass as being a great bluegrass musician. And all people who practice art, whether it is in the category of the classics or the categories of jazz or folk, always legitimately strive for greatness. That's wonderful, but for one thing, it makes everybody afraid that anything less than great is lousy. There is no spectrum in the arts within which we can practice and work out our integrities without fear of being called mediocre because we're not great. I grew up with that in the arts. I grew up almost defensively because of, my love for greatness and the appetite that the Lord gave me for great art and the appetite that I keep trying to refine and nuance the older I get. But the fear of not being great, the fear of not doing great art, haunted me so much that it almost made me afraid to make art. And there is a cult of fear in the arts because the word greatness has become exclusive to the extent to which anything less than great is held in suspicion. I'm trying to say these things as vividly as I can in order to make a point. The point is not to condemn greatness. The point is to plead for goodness. Because just as there are great men and women whose stature we can't aspire to, I'll never be able to aspire to the statesmanlike stature of Abba Ibn, the great Israeli statesman back in the 50s and 60s. I will never be able to aspire to the statesmanship of a G. Campbell Morgan in his magisterial sermon making. I will never be able to aspire to the greatness and the magisterial force and authority of a Helmut Thielicke or a Karl Barth, irrespective of whether I agree or disagree. They are great people. When I read Karl Barth, it's like listening to Johann Sebastian Bach. The intricacy of his thought, the greatness of his thought, is to me parallel to the greatness of the thought of Bach when he composed the Art of Fugue or the Mass in B minor. I am not a great person, but I do very much want to be a good person. And as I look at the canons of greatness throughout civilization, great people, great literature, great institutions, great examples, I am drawn to a pantheon of excellence that is there for me to aspire to without necessarily being afraid because I can't quite make it there. And I must content myself with goodness. I wish that were more the case in the arts. I am trying to say that there is such a thing as merely good art. And I'm using merely the way C.S. Lewis used it in the title Mere Christianity. He was really talking about basic, how mere can Christianity get. It is so mere that you cannot talk about it without talking about Jesus Christ, without talking about the atonement, without talking about the shed blood, without talking about the authority of scriptures. That is mere Christianity. And so when I talk about goodness, I want to refer to mere goodness and suggest to you that in the practice of the arts, and nobody is not in the practice of the arts, a layman or professional. Everybody somehow practices the arts. That in the practice of the arts, yes, we must be on a continual quest to understand and identify with greatness. But at the same time, we live primarily in a world of artistic goodness. Church music at its best should thrive in the world of goodness. This is good music. These are good praise tunes. This is a good hymn text. Let's not worry about greatness in the high culture, transcendently aesthetic sense, as important as that is, and as occasionally this or that hymn tune or text might reach into the up on the shelves of the repertoires of greatness. To be a good church musician, to be a good pastor, to be a good preacher, to be a good husband, to be a good student. This is a wonderful thing to aspire to, mere goodness. And I think one of the things that has hurt the practice of the arts in the church, and I was brought up this way, is to assume that the primary task of the church musician is to raise standards. That's how I was brought up. That is based on the presupposition that the standards are already low, and it's my job to raise them, no matter how high they really are. And I've come to the conclusion that is not any longer the job of a church musician. A church musician, yes, is to strive for quality, and we'll talk about quality in a minute. But the task of the church musician is to be a minister of the gospel through the practice of the arts in the contexts to which he or she is called, as if Abraham were the model going out, not knowing exactly where we're going, but trusting and excelling. And when I think of it and say it that way, I'm talking really about goodness. When I talk about goodness, instead of always talking about greatness, I think I've earned a stronger right to criticize mediocrity, which is down somewhere at the tail end of goodness. Remember this about greatness, goodness, and mediocrity. These are seamless categories in a spectrum. There is not a black-white dividing line between goodness and mediocrity any more than there is a black-white dividing line between goodness and greatness. Somehow, in the practice of things, whether it's parenting, carpentering, doing surgery, whatever, somehow in the practice of all things, there is this seamless spectrum within which greatness transists into goodness, which can transist into mediocrity. I feel peaceful saying it this way, knowing that I'm saying something dangerous that almost sounds as if it were postmodern, because I'm not drawing lines for you. And the pop tendency among evangelicals is this: whenever somebody doesn't quite draw a straight line, they're called a postmodernist. Which is, of course, stupidity, carried to the nth degree, to say that anybody who cannot draw a straight line and divide between categories is a postmodernist. In which case, Paul the Apostle is a very good postmodernist. In which case, Jesus Christ is a very good postmodernist. He did not draw certain lines that people wanted him to draw. He dealt with ambiguities to the extent to which he got crucified. So when we talk about postmodernism as the inability to find an absolute, we have to be very careful lest we, in crafting the wrong definition of postmodernism, actually critique fundamentalist Christianity in the same breath. So as you think about artistic action, as you think about exegetical work, as you think about the art and craft of homiletics, as you think about parenting, as you think about courting, as you think about doing your income tax, as you think about living, all of which comprises being a living sacrifice, the marvelous challenge of the greatness, goodness, mediocrity spectrum is always before you. And your prayer should always be that you are striving for goodness. And if the Lord deems that you become a great person, so be it. You'll be judged harshly for not pursuing greatness. But don't be afraid of the word goodness. We need that word badly back in our culture, back in our practices. This is a good man. This is a good woman. This is a good hymn tune. This is a good piece of architecture. This is a good sermon. I would only like you to think about this. I'm not laying out lessons or methodologies, but I'm pleading for the centrality of goodness. Because let's face it, nobody here is great. Maury Hinson is one of the most well-known piano pedagogues in the United States of America. He is known outside of Southern Baptist practices for what he's done. And Maury, without insulting you, I refuse to say that you're a great man. You are an excelling, superlatively good person. Does that make sense to you? We need that kind of goodness, that kind of leadership. Hugh McElrath, your new choral man, and I forget your name and I'm sorry. This good man over here, I'm terrible on names. Chip, I remember because he's Chip. He's always been Chip to me. I've known him for a long time. These are not great people. I am not a great person. There's probably nobody at Southern Seminary, faculty, administration, and student body who is, in the annals of historical ecclesiology, truly great. There are no anthropological masterpieces here that would accompany or parallel the artistic masterpieces of which I've spoken. There are no Bachs or Mozarts here. But SBTS is full of good people. Good people striving to become better than they were yesterday, which brings me to another word, excellence. Excellence to me is one of those marvelously floating, not rubbery, but flexible words. Those of you who may have ventured either optionally or by mandate from one of your teachers into a book I've written called Music Through the Eyes of Faith will locate a chapter in that book about excellence. And without going into any of its details, I want to reiterate a concept that lies in that chapter. Again, excellence is a trashed word in this culture of trashed words. Excellence out there means winning, being number one. Often to artists, it means perfection and perfectionism, two demon words for artists, two killer words for anybody. It means winning, and winning in America means beating someone else. Nobody wins in the abstract in America. They always win over somebody who's in second place. Winning, therefore, becomes almost destructively hierarchical. I don't know how many truly fine performers there are in this world of whom the public does not know because some other performer won the Moscow competition or won the Guggenheim or whatever. And so they become the myths and the legends. And those beneath them cannot be as great because they didn't win, when in point of fact, they might be just as great or even better. Because as all of us know, if you win or lose an artistic competition, it might depend on whether you had garlic the night before or not. It's something whimsical like that. But excellence is a biblical word, and it's a word that defies these paganized categories of perfection and number oneness and all of these things that infect the ethos of Western civilization, Western culture. Excellence simply means the act of becoming better than you were yesterday. Excellence is one of those Abrahamic words. It is one of those going out words, pressing on words. It's an isometric word that has to do with pushing against what appears to be immovable, so as not necessarily to get that thing moved, but to make you stronger by pushing against it. That's the whole secret to isometric conditioning. That's how Charles Atlas got so famous in the 30s when I was a kid. You know, it was isometrics. You can do the most marvelous kind of bodybuilding by just pushing this way against two doorposts, for instance. That's isometric. The doorpost will never move, but you get stronger by pushing against them. In that respect, excellence is an isometric word. Just as the Pauline terms of warring and the somnic terms of hungering and thirsting, of pressing on, fighting, all of these isometric terms really couple up and unify with the word excelling, becoming better than you were yesterday. So in the respect, let's go back to that triad, greatness, goodness, and mediocrity. The thing that is important to me as a Christian, especially if I'm put in some position of leadership, is not so much to make fun of mediocrity or to be partially satisfied with goodness and to idolize greatness. My task is an excelling task. How do I become better than I was yesterday? So that the category mediocre, for instance, becomes a category that I need not stay with. The category of goodness means that it's a category that I can sojourn within, on toward. If I were to put all of these ideas together into a question to the church with regard to greatness and goodness and mediocrity and quality and excellence, it would be simply this. It's the question that the Spirit is asking the church daily. What's your next move? What are you going to do next? Theologically, as you grow up into the stature of the fullness of Jesus, artistically, as you grow up into the stature and the fullness of what lies ahead, domestically, as you grow up into the stature and the fullness of treating your wives as if Jesus would have treated them had he been married, and wives treating your husbands as if Jesus were a woman, and I'm theologically risky when I say this. I'm not saying he was a woman. But if he were, how would he treat? Or how would she treat her husband? It's not a gender question. I'm not trying to play cute games with gender militarism. I'm simply asking the question, what does it mean to be Christ-like as a husband or a wife? This makes excelling a lot of fun. It should make every one of us both comfortable and uncomfortable. Comfortable in the sense that we're somewhere in the spectrum. Comfortable that we're doing the best that we can at the time. And uncomfortable in terms of the question raised to us by the Lord, what is your next move? That's the question for church musicians. And since this is a school of church music and worship, and since I've been trained as a musician, I bring this larger conceptual structure that I've tried to generate, I bring it down to the practice of church music. I'm less concerned about the presence of blended worship, charismatic worship, contemporary worship, emerging worship, liturgical worship, hymn-based worship, all of these separately identifiable or definable practices. I'm less concerned about these as phenomena than I am about the question, what's your next move? What's going to happen next? Because, as I suggested yesterday, all five, six of these are traditions. I refuse the idea that we have really a debate, if not a war. I don't like the term worship war. There's no war. The only worship war that I know of is the one between God and Satan. That's the only war that I know of. And these petty skirmishes of ours that we call wars simply shows us how much we've overly exaggerated our condition, whatever it is, and have overly exaggerated the condition of the other church with which we might disagree. So I'm less concerned about these six categories than I am about, and the fact that they've all become traditions. There is no such thing as traditional versus contemporary. Think it through. Nobody will choose a kind of church music unless they're already used to it. Think of the styles of music there are. Nobody comes to a church that does music that they have never heard of before. There is no such thing as an avant-garde church music program. And I could argue theologically that there should not be. although I would argue that within any church music program, the spirit of the avant-garde should always be alive and well, which is the spirit similar to that asking the question, what's your next move? So we have all of these traditions. They're frozen in various ways. Ironically, the so-called contemporary tradition, sort of birthed in Willow Creek, in a very short span of time, about a quarter of a century, has frozen itself into a tradition. And yet it's blatant enough to call itself contemporary. I don't think those... I'm not condemning the practice, don't get me wrong, but I'm saying that the use of the term contemporary is another example of trashing words. It's not contemporary. It's rather old-fashioned. And those who find themselves frozen within that are just as in need of help as those who might be frozen within liturgical or so-called traditional worship. Let me bring all of that down to the word liturgy for a minute. Let me define liturgy for you in its most basic etymological sense. If you were to have lived at the time of Paul or Jesus in a Greco-Roman culture or subculture, and if you bought a used house and you wanted the deed closed on it, you'd get a hold of the nearest lawyer in town and he would do a liturgy. That is, he would perform a service in effecting the finishing of that deed. The word liturgy comes out of the secular world of service done, work performed. Liturgy does not mean a formal set way of doing something. That is one definition of liturgy, but it's not the basic definition of liturgy. So when I use the word liturgy, I'm using it in its most basic sense as the work of the people of God in their private and corporate worship. We are, to that extent, liturgical people. We are rendering service. If we think of Samuel in the Old Testament, I love this. He ministered unto the Lord. He liturgied to the Lord. We often think of ministry as that which we do for other people, when in point of fact, way back in the Old Testament, it had to do with ministering to the Lord. That's neat, to elevate the word ministry. And to the extent to which in our faithful action we're ministering to the Lord, it's also a testament to the kenosis, the eternal kenosis of God, the eternal emptying, self-emptying of God when he is willing to be ministered to by his children. That's a most glorious concept that I by faith can minister to an emptied Lord who lowers himself to be ministered to. So, the word liturgy I'm using to refer to any kind of service that the people of God render corporately or privately. And let me now then introduce the word art or the arts into the liturgy. Bearing in mind greatness, goodness, mediocrity, quality, and excellence. The role of the arts in the liturgy, I don't care whether the church is a multi-billion dollar Anglo-Catholic parish, a multi-million dollar megachurch in Dallas or Houston, or a little country parish in Campbellsville. It matters not. The role of the arts in the liturgy is the role of service. The arts must serve the liturgy. If you want to read strong philosophical and theologically philosophical comment on this, read Nicholas Wolterstorff in his book called Art. Is it Art in Action? Or is it Art and Action? In Action. Art in Action. Nicholas Wolterstorff, just retired from Yale Divinity School as professor of philosophical theology. He's a Calvin College graduate and served there for many years on the faculty. One of the most brilliant Christian philosophers alive, and a man who truly understands the arts. He's one of these philosophers who not only... You want the spelling? Yeah, okay, just a minute. He's a man who not only thinks about the arts as a philosopher, but he thinks in the arts, which very few people do, including a lot of artists. It's very hard to think in music. It's very easy to think about music. Wolterstorff is spelled W-O-L-T-E-R-S-T-O-R-F-F. Sounds like I've sort of shaken up a bottle of letters, doesn't it? Spilled them out. W-O-L-S-T-E-R-S-T-O-R-F-F. Wolterstorff. Nick has wonderful words in that very fine book in which he differentiates between the functions of art in high culture, the functions of art in general culture, the functions of art in the church. And when he gets to the church, he identifies the task of the arts as being the task of a servant. The arts serve the liturgy. The next question is, what does the liturgy serve? The liturgy serves the Word of God. There is no other Lord, if I might put it that way, of the liturgy than the Word of God. The Word of God informs everything that Orthodox Christianity professes and would die for. The Word informs the sacraments. The Word informs the homily. The Word informs the praying. The Word informs the singing. And in a very marvelous way, the Word informs a quest for quality. Based in these concepts that I've already mentioned to you, whatever state you're in qualitatively, the question is, are you becoming better than you were yesterday, and what's your next move? Now, all of that to break into the subjects of multiculturalism. I've already alluded suggestively all through these remarks. I've alluded to diversity without mentioning that word. Yesterday, those of you who are here, I broke high culture and low culture and folk and ethnic culture. I broke those categories out. I sort of put them aside for a moment and asked you all to think in terms of couplings and pairings, if you'll remember. Instead of wondering if a piece of classical music is classical or a piece of popular music is popular or wondering which is better than the other, I suggested, and for those of you who weren't here yesterday, let me suggest those couplings again. Simple to complex. See if I can remember them because I don't have my notes in front of me. Simple to complex. Shallow to deep was the first one. Simple to complex. Entertaining to engaging. Ornamental to developmental. Was there another one? Familiar to strange. Go over them again. Shallow to deep, ornamental to developmental, simple to complex, shallow to deep, entertaining to engaging. To think of all music in those terms, whether it be Bach or Bartok or Count Basie or Blind Lemon Jefferson or a Zulu harvest song, to think of art running those changes through the spectrum is a better way to think of multiculturalism than to wonder whether Romanian folk music is better than Appalachian hymnody. Recognizing this, that whatever category of music you go to, let's say Appalachian hymnody, there will be somebody within that culture that will tell you that this piece of Appalachian hymnody is better than that piece. I once asked an ethnomusicologist. I said, her name is Vida Chenoweth, and she was not only a Wycliffe Bible translator and translated the New Testament for the Usarufan tribe in the Eastern Highlands of New Guinea, but is a very fine ethnomusicologist. I visited her tribe, and in fact, my wife and I carried the newly translated testaments up to the tribe and had the privilege of hearing them read to the tribe for the first time in their language. Probably the greatest honor I've ever had in my life, to just hear these people, to watch them just this way, while Vida read to them for the first time from a book the words of Jesus. I said to Vida, given the fact that the Usarufan tribe is a Stone Age culture, given the fact that in our way of thinking there are no philosophical institutions of thought about aesthetics, how do the Usarufans make a decision between what we would call good Usarufan music and bad Usarufan music? And here was her answer, which shows the universality of a quest for quality. She said, here's what the Usarufans would say. They would say, our fathers would not sing this. That was how they defined quality. But there it was. There it was. If you want to argue the question of quality, always go to the inside practitioner. If you want to find out what good jazz is, talk to Keith Jarrett. If you want to talk to somebody else about what good gospel is, talk to a Jester Hairston. If you want to talk to somebody else about what good classical music is, by that I mean within the classical period, talk to a classical scholar, and on and on and on. The inside integrity of any culture or subculture will always guarantee to you that there is a debate about quality. Quality is not an unknown quantity among amateurs or folk people or ethnic people, and a known quality only to the classicists or to the aesthetes. Quality is a human question, and it engages sensitive human beings in a continual quest. And so, when we approach the subject of multiculturalism, all of these musics, We do not need to sucker into the postmodernist idea that a comic book is the same as Shakespeare. But we can rather categorize and say there are good comic books and bad comic books. And there is good Shakespeare and great Shakespeare, just as those of us who have studied Bach a little bit can see in his earlier works that he was not quite as good at fugue writing as he was later on. Right, Maury? So goodness went to greatness. Quality, what's your next move? These questions faced everybody. So as you engage in the multicultural aspects, to whatever extent, I'm not here to tell you how far to go. That's none of my business. And I'll say why in a minute. But as you engage in multiculturalism, be sure that you just don't become global for the sheer heck of it. You don't become multicultural to keep up with the multicultural Joneses, but that you actually try to find out among the practitioners of the various musics or arts that you want to go into, you try to find out what to them comprises the best. That's very important. The next point about multiculturalism is this. Multiculturalism does not mean that every minister of worship and the arts becomes an ethnologist and is therefore obligated to do music of all kinds from all parts of the world. That's not what multiculturalism means. Multiculturalism does not mean becoming encyclopedic. What it means is understanding theologically that 1,000 tongues will never be enough. It further means that it's the task of every minister of the arts to find out what is appropriate for the context in which they work. how far can they go? How widely did they experiment in light of the large question, what's your next move? What's your next move? I, for 13 years, sat on the Commission for Accreditation for the National Association of Schools of Music, and for 3 years was its president. And we worked our way through the politicized multiculturalism of the 70s. And out, without being suckered by that, we worked out language in accreditational standards for cultural diversity in music curricula, and I think ended up with some really good thinking, in terms of which we said it's the duty of all institutions of higher learning to explore music from diverse historical and cultural practices, discovering for themselves what happens to be most integral for them in that study and in that quest. That would be a good way of stating it for the church. If I want to explore multiculturalism in my church, let's say I want to do some African music or some Native American music, you don't have to say that in order to be multicultural. That's what I'm getting at. But you have to understand that there will never be enough ways to praise God, and that you might choose something that goes beyond the present cultural vocabularies of your congregation. For instance, if I were down here in Kentucky, especially toward the hills, I would want to be sure that the town folk knew about Appalachian hymnody. That is multicultural in a regional sense. If I lived on the outskirts of Chicago, which I did, I'd want to find out what it meant for black churches in the South Side to worship, especially what it meant for white churches in the black centeredness of the South Side to worship. Multiculturalism, thank God, means a million things. Don't feel forced through the politicized version of it to be all things to all men. You can't. It's artificial. Here's an important thing to remember about multiculturalism, and with this I think I'm going to finish. I have to finish, come think of it. All sensitive, well-informed, and healthy multiculturalists work from a center. All multiculturalists should have something that they love more than anything else. Why do I say that? Because if they're going to explore other musical cultures, they're going to explore every one of those cultures in the sense that they too have their center. You understand what I mean? If I'm going to study Native American music from the southwestern corner of New Mexico as a multiculturalist, it doesn't mean that I give up my center. It doesn't mean that I give up what I love most, because I'm not asking the Native Americans to whom I'm going to give up what they love most. I am going to study what they love most. You follow that? So I move from my center to other centers. And the beauty of multiculturalism is the beauty of centrism, which is not very postmodernist. The postmodernists want to give up the centers. There are no centers. Everything is equal. No, they're just blasted wrong. What they fail to understand is that the most elegant kind of cultural discovery is to move as a person centered in something to all kinds of centeredness. And then you drink in the centeredness of other people. What will that do? Among other things, that'll cause them to recognize my centeredness. And remember that centeredness is not prejudice. I freely admit, as a person who probably loves as many kinds of music as anybody here, in my 71 years, my repertoire of listening widens, 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 widens. And I dare anybody to beat me in the repertoires that you own. But I say this, I've got a center, and it's Western classical music. That's my center. That doesn't mean that it has to be your center. But it means that if I go to whatever your center is, you've got to understand that I'm coming from a center because of the preciousness of being centered, of owning something personally. Therefore, I come to you who owns something personally, and we honor each other's ownership. Which is a wonderful way to break down barriers. It sounds strange at first, but to honor each other's ownership, to esteem, in Pauline terms, the other better than yourself, is a wonderful way to break into the other cultures. So don't be afraid to have a center. That is not prejudice. Unless you say, my center is the only one there is, and unless people subscribe to it, they are less than I am. That's prejudice. Whether it's racial, aesthetic, domestic, whatever. Well, I've blown on for 50 minutes, and thank you for your kind attention. And if any of you want to stay and ask questions, I don't have to catch a plane for 3 hours. So thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to come back to Southern Seminary for several reasons. One, the thing I miss most in my retirement is being away from students. And the other thing is to see the sweet grace on the faces of the faculty here and to see that I'm hard at work, loyal to Jesus, and given over to the well-being of students, even if it means you have to look at an ugly guy like Chip Stamm when he lectures.